Chapter 33. A Dance of Blood. The same flinty determination that informed Grant's spectacular campaign against the Klan harmed him when dealing with the Santo Domingo Treaty, an obsession he could not discard. In October 1870, he reassured President Baez that he would pursue the issue when Congress reconvened. Hamilton Fish was eager to wriggle free from the whole sordid mess, but he found it difficult to do so without offending Grant. Meanwhile, Charles Sumner still stewed over Motley's recall and threatened to foil Grant at every turn. In early December, when Grant sent his annual message up to Capitol Hill, it contained many fresh, forward-looking features. He wanted to rejuvenate America's merchant marine through shipbuilding subsidies, and proposed two new bureaus in the Interior Department, one for education, the other for agriculture. What was downright stale was his renewed plea to annex the Dominican nation. Far from backing down, he upped the stakes. "So convinced am I of the advantages to flow from the acquisition of San Domingo and of the great disadvantages, I might almost say calamity, to flow from non-acquisition," he wrote in his draft message, "that I believe the subject has only to be investigated to be approved." The more Grant pushed the issue, the more critics pushed back. "The president's message is good," observed Rutherford B. Hayes. "With the exception of San Domingo, it is approved by all fair-minded Republicans." Grant requested a joint resolution of Congress that would empower him to appoint a three-man commission to investigate annexation of the island nation. Such a resolution required a simple majority vote, not the higher two-thirds bar to pass a treaty. Not surprisingly, Sumner refused to introduce such a resolution. Instead, Grant turned to another member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, Senator Oliver P. Morton of Indiana, who presented the resolution on December 12. Sumner reacted with ferocity, and for 2 weeks assailed Grant in closed-door sessions of the committee. On December 20th, the New York Times reported that several senators had failed to effect a truce between Grant and Sumner. "Mr. Sumner remains as bitter as ever, and the president maintains a firm attitude inconsistent with anything like an approach toward conciliation." Far from calming down, Sumner worked himself up to his most grandiloquent indictment yet. On December 21st, with an early winter storm swirling about the Capitol, he delivered a salvo against the treaty that had become a casus belli for him with Grant. It was known as the Naboth's Vineyard speech, for he referred to Ahab, the Israeli king whose wife, Jezebel, had Naboth stoned to death to procure his vineyard. For sheer histrionics and gratuitous insults, it was one of the most vitriolic speeches in Senate annals. "The resolution before the Senate commits Congress to a dance of blood," Sumner thundered. "It is a new step in a measure of violence." He noted that Grant didn't need congressional authorization to send agents to foreign countries, but had done so to commit Congress to the policy of annexation. He took deadly aim at Baez, saying American warships in Dominican waters sustained his government. "You call him president, they call him their dictator." At this point, Senator Morton objected that Sumner had raised a frivolous point, since all groups in Santo Domingo favored annexation, not just the president. In response, Sumner unleashed his full cannonade of rhetoric. "Frivolous! Is it frivolous when I see the flag of my country prostituted to an act of wrong? Is it frivolous when I see the mighty power of this republic degraded to an act of oppression?" Sumner went on melodramatically about America bullying Haiti, claiming Grant wanted to annex the entire island, not merely the Dominican side. Stooping to a new low, he identified Grant with three former presidents who had appeased the South, Pierce, Buchanan, and Johnson, and sought the oppression of a weak and humble people. In closing, Sumner made a bizarre racial argument that the island of Hispaniola had been consecrated to the colored race. It is theirs by right of possession, by their sweat and blood mingling with the soil, by tropical position, by its burning sun, and by unalterable laws of climate. Many senators were appalled by Sumner's ugly attack, which Zachariah Chandler of Michigan termed a brutal assault. To rebut his charges, Senator Roscoe Conkling of New York rose to defend Grant and pointed out that the three-man commission was merely one of inquiry to confirm or deny the charges directed against annexation. He countered Sumner's indignation with his own. "Why, sir," he protested, "if the charges made by the senator today against the president be true, it would be necessary to convict him of being a fool in order to acquit him of being a knave." At first, Conkling seemed to mock the notion that Grant wanted to eject Sumner from the Foreign Relations Committee. Then he endorsed it by saying it should no longer be chaired by a senator who has launched against the administration an assault more bitter than has proceeded from any Democratic member of this body. Morton backed up Conkling, protesting that Grant had been treated with a bitterness of persecution and a torrent of calumny not seen since the days of Thomas Jefferson. In a rowdy debate, opposing senators roared through the night, and it was around dawn when they wearily approved Morton's resolution for an inquiry commission. Vice President Colfax went to the White House to congratulate Grant, who received a parade of jubilant lawmakers. In the following days, Sumner told Fish and Boutwell that he had always been courteous to Grant. Afterward, at the White House, the two men analyzed Sumner's manic behavior. Though an old friend of his, Fish said the Massachusetts senator was crazy and a monomaniac upon all matters relating to his own importance and his relations toward the president. For Boutwell, Sumner had fired charges against Grant so outrageous and violent that he dared not repeat them. He recalled Sumner's charge that Grant was drunk when he stopped by his house for the famous dinner chat. As proof, Sumner had cited the fact that Grant addressed him as chairman of the Judiciary Committee. "He was no more drunk or excited," recalled Boutwell, "than he was when we left him upstairs 5 minutes since, no more than Sumner himself." Sumner now took to calling Grant a colossus of ignorance, and defamed Fish as a gentleman in aspect with the heart of a lackey. He said he would have no further dealings with the Secretary of State, a rupture that threatened the very workings of government. Among those who believed Sumner trafficked in unfair invective was Frederick Douglass, who wrote to the senator and berated him for lumping Grant's name with the infamous names of Pierce, Buchanan, and Johnson. "These names, in the minds of all loyal and liberty-loving men, stand under the heaviest reproach, and I candidly think you did wrong to place Grant in that infamous category, even by implication." Only a group of neutral commissioners, Douglass argued, could engage in dispassionate analysis of the Santo Domingo question and report honestly to the American people. In defending Grant, Fish insisted that the president had maintained cordial relations with senators who opposed the Santo Domingo Treaty. He paid a remarkable tribute to Grant, stating that "no man living is more tolerant of honest and manly differences of opinion, is more single or sincere in his desire for the public welfare, is more disinterested or regardless of what concerns himself, is more frank and confiding in his own dealings, is more sensitive to a betrayal of confidence, or would look with more scorn and contempt upon one who uses the words and the assurances of friendship to cover a secret and determined purpose of hostility." In short, Fish thought Sumner had gone way beyond legitimate disagreement and behaved in a false, duplicitous manner. On January 9th, the resolution for an inquiry commission passed the House and was approved by the Senate 3 days later. For all of Sumner's bombastic invocation of black rights, opposition to the Dominican annexation had taken on a racist tinge. Carl Schurz regretted that annexation would soon bring the absorption of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and other Caribbean islands in its wake. He described these islands as populated mainly by indolent black people and issued this challenge to treaty proponents: "Show me a single instance in any tropical country where labor, when it was left free, did not exhibit a strong tendency to run into shiftlessness, and where practical attempts to organize labor did not run in the direction of slavery." Once the joint resolution cleared Congress, Grant tapped three figures of unimpeachable integrity for the commission: Andrew White, the president of Cornell University, Dr. Samuel Gridley Howe, who had done excellent work for the blind, and Benjamin F. Wade, the former Ohio senator and radical Republican. Grant had chosen impartial men of high character and didn't stack the deck in favor of annexation. White and Howe actually opposed it. Grant also chose Howe because he was a longtime abolitionist, married to the poet Julia Ward Howe and a Bostonian friend of Sumner, who would be outflanked if Howe opted for annexation. Emotions didn't cool down between Grant and Sumner. When intermediaries proposed that the abolitionist Gerrit Smith act as peacemaker between them, Grant replied, according to Sumner, that if he weren't president, he should demand personal satisfaction of Mr. Sumner. In other words, a duel. Sumner, playing the innocent, professed complete ignorance as to why Grant was so upset with him. "I have done nothing but my duty, nor have I ever made any personal impeachment of him." Stealing the moral high ground, Grant summoned to the White House Frederick Douglass, who agreed to become secretary to the commission. When it sailed to the Caribbean on January 18th, the group also included a State Department geologist, a government botanist, and a New York Times photographer. On the eve of Douglass's departure, a friend described him as enchanted at the prospect of visiting a tropical island. At Grant's behest, he enjoyed every courtesy extended to the three commissioners, joining them for meals in the admiral's cabin. At a time when this was hardly taken for granted, Douglass marveled at his equal treatment, commenting that, "While all the fools are not dead yet, the American people are rapidly outgrowing their slavery-engendered prejudices and will one day wonder how they could have so long lived under its degrading spell." Douglass's assignment was yet another example of Grant's appointing African Americans in far greater numbers than any previous president. Grant hoped that if the commission filed an unfavorable report on Santo Domingo, it would put the entire matter to rest. Some observers saw the commission as a charade, a face-saving way for Grant to disengage from a failed initiative. "The commission was intended merely to let the administration down easy," wrote former Attorney General Hoar. "It cannot report in season to do anything in this Congress, and the next will be strong against it." On the other hand, Grant hoped that if the commissioners arrived at a favorable conclusion, annexation might ensue. In fact, the commissioners reacted ecstatically to the island nation. "There is no more fruitful country on earth," Benjamin Wade wrote, "and they are so far all, without exception, crazy to be annexed. All that Grant said about it is true. All that Sumner said is false." With the commissioners away, the marathon feud between Grant and Sumner redoubled in fury. Relations had also deteriorated between Sumner and Hamilton Fish, whom Sumner anointed Mephistopheles. Fish not only thought Sumner bitterly vindictive and hostile, but believed he suffered from mental derangement, succumbing to wild, paranoid delusions that Grant and Orville Babcock had threatened to assault him. Boutwell thought Sumner's days as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee were numbered when he declined to have any intercourse with the Secretary of State outside of official business. The State Department kept sending minor treaties to Sumner, who then sat on them for months and watched as the senator pompously issued instructions to foreign diplomats in Washington. In February, after Sumner strove to thwart confirmation of Grant's brother-in-law, Michael John Kramer, as minister to Denmark, the president despaired of any improvement in the situation and threw his considerable weight behind efforts spearheaded by Senators Morton, Conkling, and Chandler to oust Sumner as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee when Congress convened in early March. In a momentous shift, Grant made common cause with party bosses, who increasingly formed the backbone of his support on Capitol Hill. When Congress came back into session, in a rare spectacle of a mighty senator being humbled by his peers, the Republican caucus voted to depose Sumner as head of the Foreign Relations Committee. The full Senate approved by a 33-9 vote, with 25 senators abstaining. even though Schertz defended Sumner and John Logan objected to intrusive executive power, the will of the body had turned unmistakably against Sumner, who was replaced by Senator Simon Cameron of Pennsylvania, a Grant supporter. By now well-schooled in Washington intrigue, the president had shown he would not be pushed around by an arrogant senator. He insisted he had nothing to do with Sumner's dismissal, but admitted he was glad when I heard that he was put off, because he stood in the way of even routine business like ordinary treaties with small countries. It was a sad sight to find a Senate with the large majority of its members in sympathy with the administration and with its chairman of the Foreign Committee in direct opposition to the foreign policy of the administration. Like many shy, reserved men, Grant was slow to take offense, but once provoked, he could be implacable in his bitterness. Walking past Sumner's house with Grant after the senator's removal, George Hoare was flabbergasted to see the president shake a fist at his window and manifest his anger. "The man who lives up there has abused me in a way I have never suffered from any other man living." Most of the time, Grant was a tactful, forgiving man, but there were limits to his patience. The self-righteous Sumner absolved himself of all responsibility for what had happened. "The president has such relations with me as he chooses," he explained smugly. "I have never declined to see him or confer with him. If there is a quarrel, it is all on his side." On March 27th, Sumner spewed forth another three-hour speech against Grant, accusing him of trampling senatorial rights and even likening him to a Klan wizard, saying it was difficult to see how we can condemn our own domestic Ku Klux with its fearful outrages while the president puts himself at the head of a powerful and costly Ku Klux operating abroad. Even those who sympathized with Grant worried about the impact Sumner's expulsion would have on Republican unity, an early sign of the schism that would split the party in the 1872 election. By the time the commissioners returned from Santo Domingo in late March, they were convinced the Dominican people wanted annexation and were surprised to concur with Grant about the wisdom of that policy. The final leg of their journey aboard a Potomac mail packet was marred by a racial incident when the captain refused to admit Douglas into the dining room with the three commissioners. Andrew White was irate that a man who had dined with the foremost statesmen and scholars of our northern states and of Europe was banished from the table. In protest, he refused to touch his food and stormed from the dining room with Samuel Gridley Howe. Later on, Sumner tried to smear Grant with the incident, saying that almost within sight of the executive mansion, Douglas had been rejected from the white man's table. Thus was the African race insulted and their equal rights denied, but the president neither did nor said anything to right this wrong. The insult was compounded, according to Grant's critics, when the president invited the three commissioners to dine at the White House on March 30th and excluded Douglas. There's only one problem with the story of the supposed presidential snub. The man who most conspicuously defended Grant's behavior was the man allegedly victimized. "There is something so ridiculous about this dinner affair," Douglas told a friend, noting that Grant was well within his rights not to invite him. Douglas made many good points to disarm critics. He pointed out that Grant had never withheld any social courtesy from the Haitian ambassador, a man of my own complexion. Every day for 10 weeks, Douglas had dined with the commissioners, and this doubtless by the president's special direction. Finally, he thought the public misunderstood the circumstances of the dinner. Messrs. White, Howe, and Wade had called on the president, who invited them on the spot to dine with him. "Had I been in company with the commissioners," Douglas wrote, "I have no question but that an invitation would have been extended to me as freely as to any of the gentlemen of the commission." Not only had Grant been uniformly cordial to him, but after Lincoln and Sumner, no man in his intercourse with me gave evidence of more freedom from vulgar prejudice. Douglas did believe, however, that Grant had thrown away a splendid opportunity to rebuke the ship captain who had snubbed him by welcoming him to a White House dinner. The president invited Douglas to the executive mansion to deliver his personal views on the mission. Sumner had chided annexation on the ground that despotic Dominicans threatened black Haitian Republicans. Douglas stood this argument on its head, stating that the Dominicans are a far superior people to the Haitians, that there is no republicanism whatever in Haiti, and that the government there is an absolute despotism of the most oppressive character, a reporter jotted down. Douglas thought Santo Domingo annexation would strike a blow at tropical slavery and raise the world's opinion of the mental and moral possibilities of the colored race. Douglas hoped Sumner would soften his opposition, fearing it would tear apart the Republican Party. If Sumner persisted, Douglas regretted, "I shall regard him as the worst foe the colored race has on this continent." On April 5th, Grant submitted the commissioner's report to the Senate and happily observed that the findings sustained his views on annexation. No less important, it refuted corruption charges and fully vindicates the purity of the motives and action of those who represented the United States in the negotiation. Grant had privately bemoaned the insinuations of fraud, corruption, crime attributed to those negotiating the treaty, and he yearned for this vindication. For Grant, the controversy had become a matter of honor as well as duty, a means to reestablish his personal reputation for incorruptibility. He didn't ask for congressional action on the report, and merely requested that it be printed and disseminated, which would end all personal solicitude upon the subject. Thumbing his nose at Sumner, Grant ended by saying that a faithful public servant, when sustained by his own conscience, can bear with patience the censure of disappointed men. If Grant thought the report might salvage the treaty, he was sorely mistaken. A public consensus had already coalesced against annexation. "The president is as stubborn as ever and seems determined to risk his all upon that one card," Schertz observed. "He seems to have a genius for suicide." Many annexation foes still exploited racist and xenophobic fears, and Sumner fulminated against the treaty at every opportunity. "Nothing has aroused me more since the Fugitive Slave Bill and the outrages in Kansas," he swore. Usually circumspect in comments about people, Grant found it hard to be politic about Sumner, whose betrayal brought strong, censored feelings bubbling to the surface. 8 months after Sumner was toppled as Foreign Relations Chairman, Grant refused to heal the breach, telling Senator Henry Wilson, "Mr. Sumner has been unreasonable, cowardly, slanderous, unblushing false. I should require of him an acknowledgment to this effect from his seat in the Senate before I would consent to meet him socially. He has not the manliness ever to admit an error. I feel a greater contempt for him than for any other man in the Senate. Schertz is an ungrateful man, and one who can render much greater service to the party he does not belong to than the one he pretends to have attachment for." Nor was Sumner in a forgiving mood. To embarrass Grant, he introduced a Senate resolution calling for a constitutional amendment to limit presidents to a single term. Although it didn't apply to the current occupant, it was clearly meant as a slap at Grant. On the Senate floor, to rousing cheers, Roscoe Conkling said that despite attacks from presses and demagogues, Grant remained secure as no predecessor for 40 years has been secure against detraction and defeat. The proposed amendment faded away along with Grant's treaty for annexing Santo Domingo. The treaty debate had been a bruising lesson in Washington power politics for Grant. He had been subjected to unconscionable attacks by Sumner, but had also made the mistake of personalizing the issue and matching the senator's animus. As Julia Grant once said of her husband, he had lots of friends and no enemies until political ones came on. This was not quite true, for he had enemies during the war who tried to injure him. But the politicians now plotting his downfall were craftier and more ruthless and had played the game far longer than he had. Grant lacked the normal human quota of cynicism and had paid for it. Some people thought he had mishandled his relationship with the vain Sumner. The senator himself complained that Grant may have sought my vote, which I did not promise, but he never sought advice and counsel. Sumner had demanded a show of deference, a bend of the knee, which Grant refused to give. The president, of course, could point to his unprecedented stroll over to Sumner's house to talk about the treaty, a novel show of deference that had clearly backfired. The demotion of Charles Sumner and the dismissal of John Lothrop Motley greatly simplified Grant's task in negotiating an end to the controversial Alabama claims. Their settlement took a dramatic leap forward in autumn 1870 when Sir Edward Thornton, Britain's ambassador, went to Fish's house for a friendly chat. Thornton surmised that Grant was eager to reach a settlement to advance his re-election prospects, and that Fish, too, craved a touch of diplomatic glory. Over cigars in his study, Fish made two statements that transformed the discussion. First, he said Washington would drop its insistence upon Canadian independence if Great Britain made satisfactory concessions on other issues. Second, instead of a timid, piecemeal approach, he proposed a far grander solution, with all outstanding disputes between the United States and Great Britain, including fisheries, boundaries, and tariffs, negotiated at once. One evening in early November, Grant dropped by Fish's house, and the two conversed for a couple of hours. Fish persuaded Grant that it was futile to pursue Canadian annexation. Many Britons ascribed to Grant a deep-seated hostility toward them, and he indeed later wrote that the British ruling class had shown an indecent haste in their recognition of a Southern Confederacy. Still, he retained a fondness for Anglo-Saxon culture, telling a friend, "It has always been my desire to cultivate the best of feeling between the two English-speaking nations, the most enterprising as well as freest nations of the world." By late December, he had given Fish his blessing to hammer out an Alabama settlement with the British. Fish had already received notice from Sir John Rose, a Canadian diplomat, that the other side was ready to bargain. In late January, the cabinet endorsed negotiations with the caveat that Great Britain admit her liability for the losses sustained by the acts of the Alabama, Fish noted. In his annual message in December, Grant expressed his firm and unalterable conviction that the British should admit their guilt. Fish knew they would consent to no such confession, and that insistence on this would only wreck the discussions. Toward the end of January, Grant and Fish responded warmly to a proposal from Sir Edward Thornton for a joint commission that would arbitrate the differences between the two nations, heralding a peaceful new way of solving international disputes. At the time, Charles Sumner still chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and made preposterous demands upon the English. Not only did he want all of Canada, but a total British withdrawal from the Western Hemisphere, including its Caribbean islands and the Falkland Islands off the Argentine coast. Circumventing Sumner, Fish lobbied other committee members and secured their support for a joint commission. On February 9th, Grant announced its creation to iron out differences with England. By the end of the month, the British-American Joint High Commission held its first meeting on the State Department premises with five representatives from each side. Grant and Fish had scored a major breakthrough in bringing the British to the table. Their participation tacitly admitted guilt that they could not publicly avow. It also meant the administration had prevailed over Sumner, Ben Butler, and other Republicans hankering for a collision with Great Britain. Acting on Fish's suggestion that his commission appointments show a bipartisan spirit, Grant included Samuel Nelson, an associate justice of the Supreme Court, and a Democrat. For the next 9 weeks, Grant and Fish, who served as an American commissioner, crisscrossed Lafayette Square innumerable times to consult each other. The commission sessions proceeded amicably, and the British were pleasantly surprised to find the Americans a very gentlemanly, good set of fellows socially, and Fish quite English in manner and appearance. One British commissioner thought Grant's re-election the mainspring of the whole machine of the commission. While the diplomats deliberated, Sumner was ousted as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, markedly improving the prospects for treaty ratification. While not admitting guilt over the Alabama, the British commissioners conceded that, as a neutral government, they should have used due diligence to ensure that British-built vessels weren't armed for combat against another nation. When they confessed to negligence and regret, Grant and Fish were satisfied. The British also agreed to submit damages claimed by the United States to binding arbitration. The Joint High Commission recommended the creation of a 5-man arbitration tribunal based in Geneva, with members chosen by a team of world dignitaries: President Grant, Queen Victoria, the King of Italy, the President of the Swiss Confederation, and the Emperor of Brazil. On May 8th, the British and American commissioners gathered in a flower-bedecked room at the State Department and affixed their signatures to the Treaty of Washington. One British commissioner dropped scalding sealing wax on the fingers of a harried clerk preparing the final treaty document, leading the latter to burst into tears. With this mishap safely resolved, the commissioners celebrated their achievement over plates of strawberries and ice cream. Presented to a special Senate session in early May, the treaty was so imaginatively fair-minded that even Sumner, that eternal skeptic, couldn't fault it. The American press registered enthusiastic support, and on May 24th it won Senate approval by a lopsided margin. Its ratification ushered in a new era of closer relations between the United States and Great Britain, while offering a precedent for settling disputes peacefully among leading nations. Enshrined as a milestone in diplomatic annals, it established Hamilton Fish as one of the most innovative secretaries of state in American history, and Grant as a major mediator and consensus builder. Grant felt liberated from the curse of Charles Sumner, who had choked off treaties and other pressing diplomatic measures. After the agreement passed, Fish wrote to Simon Cameron, "Since you took charge in the Senate of the business from this department, I have felt that important measures were no longer to be smothered and pigeonholed in the committee room." For much of Grant's first term, Fish had been restless, periodically threatening to quit. Grant could be abrupt and impulsive, and Fish, with his smooth professionalism and thorough preparation, had saved him from many errors. From the outset, Fish had expected to serve only a brief period, and knew the Alabama settlement would qualify as the high water mark of his tenure. Once the Senate approved it, he told Grant he would like to depart on August 1st. Grant, who knew Fish's worth, was taken aback and pleaded with him to reconsider, saying he would rather forfeit any other cabinet member. "I urge reasons for my resigning," Fish recounted in his diary, "and he meets them by admitting that it involves great sacrifice to me to remain, but he could not replace me to his own satisfaction." Grant admitted to Vice President Colfax that he kept Fish in his cabinet through sheer persistence, "but seeing as I do that he is suffering in health, I have not the heart to urge him stronger than has already been done to remain longer than he has consented to." Though a newcomer to politics, Grant had learned the lesson of heeding professional counsel. Already meditating a second term, Grant prevailed upon Fish to stay past the November elections. Congressional Republicans also applied pressure, fearing he would be succeeded by Senator Oliver P. Morton of Indiana. "If Morton succeeds you or otherwise goes into the cabinet," Senator Chandler warned Fish, "it will be impossible for the Republican Party to carry the next presidential election, for nobody has any confidence in him." In July, Fish complained about the severe and confining duties of my office and tendered his resignation anew, only to have Grant rebuff it again. With such a capable Secretary of State, Grant made sure the American public knew how deeply he himself had been involved in shaping the Treaty of Washington. As he told a reporter, "The facts are that every article of the treaty was submitted to me after it was adopted by the commission and approved by me, and that each article was in the same way submitted to the British cabinet and approved by the ministers of the crown at once. The treaty," he boasted, had done nothing less than stave off war with Great Britain. "Settlement or war were the alternatives," he told one reporter flatly, punctuating his conclusion by brusquely tossing aside his cigar. Because only one American would be appointed to the Geneva Tribunal, the selection was consequential. At first, Grant resisted naming Charles Francis Adams Sr., betraying his old grudge against the Adams clan. "I confess to a repugnance to the appointment of an Adams," Grant advised Fish, "which I would not feel to the appointment of an out-and-out Democrat." In the end, Fish convinced him nobody was better acquainted than Adams with the history of rebel cruisers built in England, and Grant bowed to his advice. He balked, however, at appointing William Evarts as counsel to the Geneva Tribunal, a suave, masterful lawyer who had served as Andrew Johnson's private counsel during the impeachment trial. Evarts was too associated with Johnson to be acceptable in Grant's mind. Yet when Fish cited the imperative need for a distinguished counsel, Grant yielded all personal feeling and cordially agreed to his appointment, said Fish. As a general rule, he asserted his own views tenaciously and firmly. On December 5th, Fish, having drafted instructions for the tribunal counsel, handed Grant his resignation after a cabinet meeting, and Grant grew flustered. In his diary, Fish said Grant was very sorry, etc., did not know what he should do, referred to the good feeling existing through the country, and the confidence of the public and of the Republican senators and congressmen in me. Grant didn't want to force Fish to stay unwillingly, but he dreaded his departure. As rumors surfaced that he might resign, Senators Conkling, Cameron, and Frelinghuysen issued strenuous pleas for him to stay. Such was the lofty esteem in which Fish was held that Vice President Colfax, along with 44 senators, signed a letter begging him to stay in office. By December 20th, Fish informed Grant he wouldn't retire as Secretary of State, and the president's relief was immediately visible. As Fish informed his diary, he replies with great warmth, thanking me, and says, "I cannot express to you what a great gratification it affords me. I could not fill your place, and the country has, as I have, the greatest confidence in your administration of the foreign policy of the government." Grant's reaction was understandable. Fish had provided expert judgment, reflecting more credit upon Grant than perhaps any other cabinet member. He stood as a one-man rebuke to charges of mediocrity leveled at the administration. On Reconstruction issues, Grant operated from deep knowledge and long experience, but when it came to the niceties of diplomacy, he was an amateur at sea, sorely needing a veteran hand. For Grant, Fish was the ideal cabinet member because he never hesitated to disagree or warn of dangers inherent in a given course of action. At the same time, once Grant made up his mind, he was unshakable, and Fish loyally carried out his directives, whether he supported them or not. No sooner did the arbitration tribunal hold its inaugural session in mid-December at the Hôtel de Ville in Geneva. An American, a Briton, a Swiss, a Brazilian, and an Italian composed the polyglot crew, than it foundered on the explosive issue of indirect damages. American representatives pointed out that the treaty had stipulated that all issues could be presented for arbitration. Aside from seeking payment for vessels directly damaged by the Alabama and other raiders, the United States wanted Great Britain to foot the bill for the entire war cost after Gettysburg, some $2 billion, the logic being that after Gettysburg, the Confederacy had abandoned offensive operations except at sea. If the British hadn't provided naval aid, the South couldn't have prolonged the war, and Great Britain was therefore liable for the extra astronomical expenses incurred. The ghost of Charles Sumner, who ranted that Great Britain had extended the war by 2 years, reared its ugly head in Geneva. Despite private reservations on the issue, Grant knew his re-election chances would be imperiled if he retreated entirely on indirect damages. As for Fish, he knew the Senate would recoil at any agreement that ignored it. As American demands cropped up in the London press, they met with a shrill outcry from the Tory opposition, fostering an almost warlike mood. Prime Minister Gladstone gave his opinion to Queen Victoria that the conduct of the American government in this affair is the most disreputable he has ever known in his recollection of diplomacy. His cabinet sent a stinging protest to Washington, while Gladstone reassured the British public that it would be insane to accede to demands which no nation with a spark of honor or spirit left could submit to even at the point of death. Benjamin Moran, secretary of the American legation in London, was stunned by the decline of American support even among Britons who had fervently embraced the Union cause. They look upon this claim for consequential damages as dishonest and as confirming the popular English opinion that we are a tricky people. On February 6, 1872, with stock markets gyrating wildly, Grant's cabinet met to ponder the British protest and refused to yield on indirect claims. "We must go on," Grant intoned, prompting unanimous nods from his department heads. "I want you, Mr. Fish," he added, "to instruct Mr. Adams to remain and sign the award alone if all the others withdraw." Ever truthful, Fish reminded Grant that the treaty required approval of the majority of the tribunal. Writing to Badeau, Orville Babcock explained that the presidential campaign had strengthened Grant's hard line on indirect claims. "If England backs out, all our people will stand by the president. If she stands by the treaty, all will say it is because Grant stood firm." In the end, Grant instructed Charles Francis Adams to travel to London and offer quiet guarantees to the British that the United States wouldn't insist on gigantic payments for indirect damages, but would settle for a tribunal statement that it possessed the right to pass judgment on the question. As the Geneva Agreement came to a vote in May 1872, Grant showed a growing mastery of the legislative process, inviting members of the Senate and House Foreign Relations Committees to meet him at the State Department, where they pored over diplomatic correspondence from Switzerland. Eager to show that he sought advice and consent from the Senate, he accepted an invitation from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to consult with them. On May 18th, Grant climbed into his carriage and was about to depart for the capital when Fish intercepted him and advised that as a mere matter of etiquette and courtesy, the committee should call upon him, not he on them. At the time, presidents weren't supposed to dabble in legislation in this way, and Fish worried that treaty opponents would charge Grant with exerting undue influence over its passage. After considering, Grant dismounted from the carriage. In taking a tough stance on the Alabama claims, Grant played a winning hand with the American public. Thomas Nast published a cartoon in which Grant and Fish stood beneath a sign warning, "No more concessions, U.S. Grant. Let us have peaceful arbitration." At their foot crouched a big, whimpering British lion and the caption, "Our president puts his foot down, and the British lion will have to wriggle out." Grant achieved a historic diplomatic triumph. In September, the Geneva Tribunal handed down a judgment that Great Britain was culpable in allowing the Alabama and other raiders to be built in British shipyards and owed the United States $15.5 million. The indemnity helped Grant redeem outstanding public debt left from the war, and he basked in the immense success of the outcome. "We are quite content with the Geneva Award," Fish informed Elihu Washburn. "It decides that Great Britain was culpable." Settling the Alabama claims is an obscure episode that has receded in history and sounds a trifle dated and musty, of interest only to professional historians. Yet its dramatic importance cannot be overstated, for it showed the value of international arbitration, banished lingering ill will between the United States and Great Britain, and launched a new fraternal relationship of major consequence. As the United States emerged as the world's foremost industrial power, Great Britain served as the premier banker to American railways and factories, powering the country's economic growth at a time when American finance could not have managed the feat alone. Adam Badeau noted that while much credit for the Alabama settlement belonged to Fish, Adams, Everts, and other American diplomats, Grant was the head. It was for him always to decide. If he had been backward or uncertain, if he had failed in judgment or nerve or sagacity or decision, the achievement would have been impossible. If there were no other measure of his administration worthy of praise, this one makes it well for America that Grant was president.